Hey folks, this is Philip with the Everyday Fighter Podcast, where we share stories and insights from everyday fighters just like you. Today, I'm going to be speaking with Hanshi Dave Kovar. Now, if you've been in the martial arts industry for any amount of time, you'll recognize that name. Hanshi Kovar is a juggernaut in the martial arts industry. He has not only a successful group of schools himself, but he also acts as a consultant, sharing with other schools methods for attracting new students, retaining those students, and helping these schools contribute to their community as well. So he's got just a wealth of knowledge, and we really dove quite a bit into that today, not only in terms of his own story, but also some of the things that he recommends to young school owners as well. But before we jump into that, I wanted to get into our episode spotlight. Now, just as a reminder, these spotlights are unsponsored. These people have no idea that I'm doing this. Most of the time, they have no idea who I am. But there once in a while, I run into organizations or individuals that are doing great work in the world, and I just want to shed a little bit more light on them. And today, I wanted to talk about the Good Dad Project. Now, this is a podcast and a community that is created by Larry Hagner. Larry has put together a community for dads. So if you are a dad that's looking to level up in your own life, level up in your relationships with your spouse and children, this is the place that you want to check out. They have an online Facebook community. I'm actually part of the Dad Edge Alliance, which is their mastermind community. And I cannot recommend these guys enough. So you can find them at gooddadproject.com. That is it for our episode spotlight. Let's jump into my conversation with Hanshi Dave Kovar.
Be 60 in a few months, and I share that with you because probably in the mid 60s, I was living in Montana with my family, and I was probably 5 or 6, I don't know, and I saw a silhouette of a guy doing a flying sidekick on a billboard, and it's really locked into my memory banks forever. I don't even know what it was. I don't know if it was a martial arts school or what it was, but all I knew was I don't know what that is, but that's what I want to do, and it's kind of like. I didn't find martial arts. I feel like martial arts found me, and then it took, of course, years, for my folks to let me do it. Back then, kids just didn't do that. It was kind of my father being a minister. He's a very open minded and liberal guy. But with that said, there was this kind of scare towards that might be something, evil or mystical or something like that. So we moved to California, and I started wrestling in 1971. That was my first kind of sport. And then my brother went away to college. My older brother Tim, who was my business partner for 20 years, and he took a year of taekwondo at a college and came back and told my folks, "Man, you gotta let Dave do martial arts." So my folks enrolled me at the local martial arts school around the corner, and that was like September of 73. And my mom likes to say, and we didn't see him again until he was 19, or something. But I don't know about you, but I was that kid that, I was that kid that was, I used to take the bus, from school that would drop off right across the street from the school. That would be whenever school gets over 3:30. And my dad would pick me up at 9. And, that was pretty much what I did all through high school. And then I kind of fell into a school about 6 months out of high school, November 1978, my instructor, who's a very well-known high-level martial artist in certain circles. Like, you don't see him in the magazines, but his name is Hanshi Bruce Jutnik, and pretty amazing martial artist. I still have a great relationship with him, but I was kind of quasi-managing his school. No disrespect, Hanshi Bruce, but he didn't pay me much, so I mostly worked for free, like everybody did. So I had another job, and so there was another guy that had opened up a school, kind of, it was one of my co-students under Hunchy Bruce, and it wasn't working for him. So they kind of said, hey, Dave, do you want to take the school over? So I borrowed some money from my folks and took over the school that had six members. And I talked to my folks into loaning me the money if I told them I would continue to go to college. And I really only went to college because they'd pay for my car insurance if I registered at the local junior college. That was where it started. And of course, you know, trial and error, it's still trial and error. You know, I'm still trying to figure it out, but I'm a lot better at it now, you know? And we struggled through the late, as long as I had enough money to go to a tournament, that kind of thing. And then the school struggled up until and I had day jobs. I painted houses for a while and whatnot. But what happened is this is probably before your time, but maybe this is the reason why you started. There was this movie that came out. I'm trying to get that name of it. I'm just joking. It was Karate Kid. And I'll never forget it. This is a true story. I was painting houses, and this is like the Karate Kid came out in 84, and I reopened a commercial school. I was teaching my old school out of my garage and out of a health club until then in 86. And I would paint houses. I'd get done. And by the way, my boss was also one of my students, so he was very supportive. He let me get off early, et cetera. So I'd paint from like 7 to 3. I'd go home, shower, and I'd race to school. I'd get there at like 3:45, and there would be a friggin' line of parents with their kids waiting. It was just like the perfect storm. It was great times.
Nice.
And so it wasn't too long before I was doing that full time. And then my brother came on in October of 87, which was actually the same year I got married. So I remember him telling me, you're going to get married twice this month, once to your wife and once to me as your business partner, right? it was, like I said, it was the perfect storm. There was very few. Ironically enough, I when I was looking to reopen this school in 86, I was painting, I saw this space, and I go, man, that's the space I want. It was a 1,000-square-foot little dojo or potential dojo in the area that I wanted. So I happened to have in my glove box, a business plan for how to run a martial arts school that I'd written for a class I was taking, right? How to open a martial arts school. So I pull into it. I read the sign. I call. I make the appointment. I show up to this guy, and this guy's beautiful, big office. And here I come in. I got paint all over me, and I'm a kid still, right? And he's looking at me like, "You want me to lease space for you to do what? Martial arts? But I happen to have this. Hey, wait a minute. I have something. I was able to go out and bring out of my glove box this business plan. It was enough for him to be okay. I'll give you a year lease, right? And so. But I'd share that with you because in the business plan, I did a comprehensive study of the competition. And in Sacramento County and the region, I should say, right now there's 2.3 million people. Probably then there was 2 million. So there's a lot of people. There was 18 martial arts schools back then. Now there's like 250, right? Just to put it in perspective. So, but there was this real wave of people that wanted their kids, Karate Kid was on every kid's mind and every parent's mind. And fortunately, because my brother was my partner I've always enjoyed working with kids and it came pretty natural to me. But what Tim is my business partner, this was before people had program directors, you just didn't really, hey, I was able to focus all my attention on the floor and he was doing basically everything else. And so we, by the early 90s, we have actually the facility that I'm talking from now, which is our headquarters school. We had over 900 members in the year 1992 in one location. Yeah. It was crazy times. And I was teaching almost all the classes.
Seriously.
I had some guys with me, but I was absolutely convinced that if I didn't teach all the classes, no one was going to want to, that was the reason why people were training. And
they're running there for you?
Is that that's what I thought. And my brother would say, hey, Dave, man, you can't, you got to get some people trained. So I had it to where we have several rooms. I would start one room and I would teach that class for 20 minutes and I would turn it over to my assistants and I'd run in the other room and I'd do that. And I would be doing that like 6 days a week, right? And, that's where like the instructor's creed came from. It was me kind of talking to myself, I'll teach this class, And so slowly over time that happened. Every time that we as hard as it was on my fragile male ego, every time I trained somebody to teach, all of a sudden classes, you know, got better, right? But I remember one time that the interesting kind of dream that I had that I'll never forget is that this was right when we couldn't, I could not have been busy. You know, I think I was, on Wednesdays, I taught 10 classes, including like a couple morning classes, you know, at a private lesson, and then 6 or 7 evening classes. However many you can stack between 3 and 9:30, or we did actually go to 10 with some of the students. So,
wow.
And I remember having this dream, and in the dream, it was there was a bunch of people that were over for dinner, and I had this one bottle of wine that was supposed to be this amazing bottle of wine. By the way, I don't even drink wine, but and so the only way I could get everybody to have a sample of it is I had to water it down with water enough for everybody, and then it didn't taste very good. Yeah. And it hit me. You get the metaphor. It
hit me. Absolutely.
Like that. That's what I'm doing. You know, it was like, and so that was when we really started kind of focusing on really working and really developing teaching methodologies and systems. And because once again, I had my older brother, I wasn't doing like what all my contemporaries at the time were, where they had to run the business. And I was just able to just focus on that. So, so it kind of gave us a little bit of an edge. So, and so, yeah. And I think, and then we just kind of expanded from there. And life is good. It's been a little over 40 years now that I've had a school, and we're still going strong.
Yeah. Wow. How important was that to you? I mean, like, because you didn't have to have, like you're saying, kind of like your competitors, they're doing it all.
Right.
You had somebody that you could lean on for that. I mean, did you realize what you had at the time?
I did. You know, it's one of the things that, as a matter of fact, the way it went down is I kind of saw the potential before, like in 86, I saw all these people, you know, coming into my school and how try to process it. And I'm the guy to this day, you know, my wife, you know, balances the checkbook. She pays the bills, you know, at work, I don't do any of that stuff. Now, by the way, I understand stats. I can tell you, ask anybody I work with. I know all the numbers in our school. I keep track of it. I understand the value, but I'm not the guy that likes to do that. And so when my brother came to work, he actually opened up, he'd tell the story. He opened up the bottom drawer and I had a year of bank statements that were unopened. You know, the reason why I'd go to my ATM, okay, there's money in the account. That's,
right.
That's how I did it. But I knew that I needed more, but I also knew I wasn't going to do it. In other words, if I had to do that stuff, I would freaking go back to paint houses. It's not, you know, some things you know, there are new. And the key thing is that you work with your strengths and then things that you're weak at. What I've always tried to do is find other people that are good at that. And so, no, I was very well aware of the opportunity, you know, that I had. And the other thing is that, to me, martial arts has always been paramount. Like today, honestly, I may be bragging a little bit, but I've already trained 3 times a day. I was at the gym for an hour. I did a private lesson in jiu-jitsu, and then I trained with 2 black belts in jiu-jitsu for 45 minutes. And then that's just today. I'll do other stuff other days. But my point is that my brother always encouraged, like a lot of times where other guys couldn't get into training because they're teaching.
Right.
During the day, they're working on their business, man. That was something that I've always loved doing. And now my current partner, Dave Chamberlain, who's been, since my brother retired 12 years ago, has been the CEO. He gets it too. He totally gets it. So a kind of R&D, so to speak, has been an important thing for me because that's kind of helped. You know, keep the, you know, maybe you've heard me talk about this before, but to me, it's martial arts first, teaching second, business third. And you want to have a successful business for the long haul. And, you know, we know people that have had short-term success, you know, but then they fall off the radar. And I think it's because, you know, if you're trying to figure out how you can get rich quick, it's going to tweak the way you do things. And you might have a good year, you might have a couple good years, but you know what I'm talking about. You put the dollar first before student service and all that. And then realizing, man, our floor's got to be solid. But then I know from experience that I'm a way better teacher, which is half the key of having a successful school.
Sure.
Which people forget, man. You got to have a guy that steps on the floor that wants to be there and knows what the heck he's doing. You know, and that's such – that's the X factor that is so important. And I know that most people are not like me in that when they're feeling good about their own training, then they're better teachers naturally. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's just kind of a certain order. Now with that, you got to be respectful of your age, right? So like when I say martial arts first, teaching second, business third, you know, just you might have an injury. You know, you may, I'm not doing the same stuff I did when I was 30, but I'm trying to live the life. I'm not saying I always do it, but I'm aspiring to. And to me, what's interesting, the difference between how I feel about martial arts now as to when I would have been when I was 25 or 30, is that I look at health and fitness as part of my training. In other words, the line is very blurred for me. Like if I'm eating, you know, a real clean meal, is that martial arts? Well, I kind of think it is. Mm. You know, meaning, for twofold. Number one, if I want to be able to do this when I'm old, I got to take care of my body. How many people do you know that used to be able to kick really well that can't lift their freaking leg up anymore because they have their hips replaced because they push too hard? You get what I'm saying?
Mm.
And so I kind of look at that is that number one, so I health first, then fitness, then martial arts follows that. Because that'll allow me to do this for a long haul. And then the other thing is if you're really thinking about really teaching, I'm going to call it true self-defense. Okay. You know, neither of us are probably going to die in a back alley. Probably, you know what I'm saying? As much fun as it is to do that kind of stuff, you know, it's going to be heart disease. It's going to be, you know what I'm talking about? It's
right.
Going to be, you know, cancer of some kind. A lot of stuff that could be avoided, not always, but minimized by take care of yourself. I remember one time I had there's this local guy. He's a good guy, but he's this hardcore blade guy. And by the way, I'm a blade guy. I mean, I enjoy that as well. I've been doing Filipino weapons for a long time. I get it. But this guy is like, how many blades do you have on you right now, babe? You always got to have three on you anytime. You never know, you know. And I get it, but because you never know. At the same time, he's eating a double cheeseburger.
You
know?
Right.
I look at him. I go, dude, that's not going to kill you. That's going to kill you. You know.
Right.
So to me, kind of, it's like you know, it's a lifestyle. It's not, you know, just what you do when you bow on the mat.
That's very, very interesting. I want to go back a little bit to was there a kind of that struggle, I think, that a lot of people have, and not just in martial arts, right, or running a school or anything, but like they, I think in terms of like even business, people get into business because they, you know, it's like, oh, I'm just going to hang my shingle because I enjoy it. I'm good at it or whatever. But then they realize, oh, shoot, it's not just about the thing that I enjoy doing. There's a money side to it as well. There's a business side to it as well. And you said, like, you know, for you, you had the benefit of having somebody that you could lean on for that. Was there something that gave you that realization that there were some things that I'd rather just lay off? Was it like a pain point, or was it just, it just made sense for you just to let go of it?
Yeah. I think, it's been said by every philosopher since the dawn of time, and I'm probably going to get it mixed up, but to really win, you have to know yourself. I forget how Shakespeare says it, I don't know, you know yourself better than anybody. You know what your strengths are and you know what your weaknesses are. And you can rah-rah yourself into saying, I'm going to do this. You know, I need to, you know, but at the end of the day, are you really going to do that? You know what I'm saying? It's like I've always wanted to learn Spanish, right? And I took it in college. I did at high school. Actually, I took 4 years of Spanish one. It's a joke, I flirted with my teacher for 4 years and she passed me, right? But since then, my wife is Hispanic, you know, and I live in California. It makes total sense that I should, you know, learn Spanish. But I always wanted to, but I'm not bad enough to do it. Does that make sense? And so what I'm saying is you kind of, yeah, I should probably do that, but are you really gonna? And not that I couldn't force myself to do it by any stretch, right?
Sure.
But if you can find somebody, that you're compatible with, that is really good and enjoys doing something that you're not really good at, nor do you enjoy doing it, then, in a football team, there's not 11 quarterbacks, you know what I'm saying? I mean, everybody's got a different position.
Right.
So that's kind of how we built our business model, is trying to find, you know, a person that's got a unique set of strengths that work in concert with other people on our team.
But that wasn't something that you found that you had to struggle through. Like you, it sounds like you learned that fairly early on, right? Or
yeah, I think so. I'll tell you what happened. Early 80s. So I opened up a school in 82, 78. In 82, I had moved to locations. I actually had, I didn't keep track of stats. Nobody kept stats then. You know, no one knew. I couldn't tell you how many students I had. I would guess I probably had about 100 or something. So it was a pretty solid size school back in the early 80s, right? But I gave everybody had a deal. No one paid full price, right? I think full by the way, full price was $40 a month, okay? But here's a story that puts it, because this is when I was doing all the program directing. This is a true story. So my rent is like the fourth of the month. My rent, of course, is due on the first, late on the fifth, right? I'm shy like $100. And I'm thinking, and you know, when you're desperate, you do things. You make it happen. Well, this guy came in, and I did my presentation. And at the time, my rates were $40 a month, and you paid first and last month. Okay, that was the deal. So in theory, I'm supposed to get $80 out of him, right? So I do I had this three-lesson private lesson system that I learned. It's the third lesson. I sit down. I go through this, and I'm looking at him, and he's in his mid-20s, and I'm thinking, he can't afford $40 a month. So without even, you know, I just said, well, the normal rate is $40 a month, but I'm only going to charge, first and last, but I'm only going to charge you $30. And then he looks at me, I'll never forget this. He looks at me, gives me this look like, and I'm thinking, oh, maybe I should only charge him $20. But no, it wasn't that. He goes, oh, really? He pulls out a $100 bill and he goes, I heard it was going to cost me $80 to get started. I had to run down to Der Wiener Schnitzel to get change for that $100 bill and give him back the money that would have paid my rent.
Right.
Because I was afraid to ask. And so I knew early on, so what happened is that I'm struggling. I'd never done anything else. So I didn't know. I had at school for 4 years and I didn't really know if I wanted to do this for the rest of my life. I'm engaged to a girl that wants me to get a real job. My folks want a real job. My brother, who was going to be my future partner later on, was saying, Dave, go back to school, get a real job. And this guy comes in off the street. I swear to God, you can't make this stuff up. His name was Ted Dodson. And he's since deceased, a really good guy though. And he came in and he had a rich uncle. He was, and he says, yeah, we just moved from St. Louis, taught almost the same system of American Kempo, very similar that I was teaching at the time. And said, I have a rich uncle who wants to help me get a school. Do you want to sell yours? And it was like, you know, my heart's, you know, I'm thinking, you know, by the way, I had a bunch of debt because I'd moved and borrowed more money. Okay. So I owed my folks money, my grandparents' money. And so we make this transaction and, you know, it was a lot of money at the time. And instead of paying off all my debt, I do something really smart. By the way, you know, at the time, my dad has always been a guy that was always said, buy silver. Silver was about $40 an ounce at the time. And he said, Dave, buy some silver with any of that money, you know. So what I did is I bought some silver, but the rest of the money, I bought a little Porsche 914. It was a piece of crap that I paid way too much money, and I had to dump a bunch of money into it. And then silver went from $40 an ounce to $5 an ounce. You know, all of a sudden, I had... Now I don't have my school anymore. I still have all the debt, and I have nothing to show. And so that went on for, it took me 3.5 years before I had an actual, you know, I was still teaching at that same school. I was still, I taught consistently the whole time, but it took me 3.5 years before I could open up. But I share this with you because at the time it was, oh, by the way, the gal I was engaged with, you know, that split too. So that it was like a hard time, man. It was like really probably the lowest point in my life. But what happened is during that, you know, that's how, you know, you can get, you know, textbook knowledge that you read in a business book, and then you have experience, you know what I'm saying? And good judgment comes from bad judgment remembered, right? Mm. And so that I went back into it. I was way more aware of, I'm way more appreciative when I opened back up the school about the fact that this is really what I wanted to do, having a taste of the real world. And I was way more guarded about making sure I do it right. So before I'd done it all myself, and I knew, hey, I had all these students, I couldn't even pay the rent because I didn't, and I was still going to be that guy. You know, I'm still that guy. They keep me away from any financial negotiations because I'll just give away. But I know that. Okay. So I've got somebody else to take care of that partner's part so I can focus on what I'm doing.
So you got a bit of pain. You got a couple of knocks and everything that's like, okay, I need to do things differently. It wasn't just like an intuitive thing for you.
No doubt.
I mean, God, even with all that, like how did you, like you're hearing this, right? I mean, like the people that love you, they want the best for you. And, you know, saying, okay, go down another path, right? And then having to eat maybe a little bit, maybe a lot of humble pie of like, yeah, what, but you still stuck with it in some way. There's still something. You didn't completely abandon it.
No, never.
So you had to do what they said eventually because you're forced to it. How did you just kind of still keep it in mind?
So, you know, you kind of, I think it was a combination of, I don't know what other skills, you have. I don't know if you could go into other fields or whatnot, but I kind of know my limitations and I've got a lot of them. Mm. And I didn't really, I may have, for example, when I was, before I'd sold the school, I actually, and this was back like in the, late 70s. I had a school for a couple of years and I wasn't doing that. I was just struggling. But, half my friends were in law enforcement or corrections. And so I actually, okay, everybody's saying do that. Okay, I guess that's what you do. It seemed like the martial arts thing to do at the time. And so I actually went through all the tests to get hired on and I actually got hired by Sacramento County Sheriff's Department as a, in their training department, which means it's a paid to go through the academy. It was a very cool thing to do. And then I had to realize, you know what? That's not what I want to do. So I guess what I'm saying is that I always wanted to teach martial arts, so I my gut kind of told me there's a way to do this. You know what I'm saying? You're going to figure it out. You're just going to kind of pound away and nothing else really really interested me, or did I feel like I could excel at it? So, I just kind of, you kind of gut it out, I guess.
Like the more you try different things, like the more you realize, well, no, this is what I really want.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I mean, you gave yourself that opportunity to check out other things.
Yeah.
I mean, and not even necessarily by your choice. I mean, it was like you were in a situation like, I got
to
do it.
I tell you what, anytime to this day, but I'm not on the floor as much anymore. I do seminars, I teach my instructors, and I'll be a guest instructor at our schools, but it's not like I haven't been on the floor every evening for years, right? But when I was and still I think about it, I have this vision. Like I remember sitting down after class number, this is like the early 90s. It's Thursday, my voice is gone, I'm dehydrated. And I'm thinking, oh man, how am I going to get through two more days? And you have that class where all that kid shows up, that kid, right? I don't know, he's got four of his friends, and I go, how am I going to get through this? And then I'd have this vision of carrying 2 5-gallon buckets of paint up 3 flights of stairs into a cockroach infested apartment complex in 110 degree weather to do sheetrock there, Mm. And quickly that makes me go, oh no, I'm blessed.
I'm blessed.
Yeah. So that was really helpful. And I would not have ever, I would have always wondered. And by the way, no disrespect to other careers, it's just that this is, it's just, I feel really blessed that I was able to, I still to this day love my job. It doesn't mean I don't like days off. Some days I don't feel like, we all have our ebbs and flows, But overall, I kind of feel like I was very lucky to fall into something that I really enjoy doing, that I really believe in, and of course, you're a martial arts, I'm talking about the impact that we can have as an industry on our communities is pretty dramatic. It's pretty amazing.
Let me ask you, as far as the, you talked about the moments when the Karate Kid came out and you now just got this line out the door for you, high demand now. A lot of people, particularly if the schools are struggling right now, they're like, oh God, I would love to have that, Yeah. Of course, there's another side of it. As well, mm-hmm. What were the challenges for you, whether it was then or like even other times when you got like this landfall, like, wow, this is great. And it's like, oh shoot, be careful what you ask for.
Yeah. Well, I think I got to say, I say that like that's the good old days. I remember one night about this time, we had 22 first lessons in 20. But in the year, I still have my stats. If I could take you 5 minutes to find it, but I still have my stats for 1993. And in 1993, we enrolled five. This is when we still had one school. We just started opening up our second school later that year. We enrolled 567. We enrolled 567 members in 1 year in one location. That's, I think, 47 a month average, right? And we really didn't know what we were doing. I mean, we did what we were doing. But here's the issue, though, is that we 540 were going out the door. We were just playing.
Mm.
And I got to say, it's still a great time to be in the martial arts industry. 2018 was our best year in business.
Wow.
40 years. It's our best year now. But it's not because the phone is ringing off the hook or the internet leads are coming in. They're coming in, but we're a lot better with them. We know how to target and we know how to keep our people a lot better. So it's become really a retention business. So when I share those back in the day stories, yeah, man, you know, last month we enrolled in the 8 schools that my company owns here in Sacramento. We have some licensed schools that are in the area and also on the East Coast. But we enrolled approximately 15 members per location in the month of January, right? Okay, so solid, 120 members. And we're, you know, that was a good solid. We have what we track is what's called, we call net new. So if it doesn't matter how many enroll, if you enroll 120, then you lose 160, you're going backwards, right? So we just try to, yeah. And we had a really nice net new because we had a lot less people. So we really focus on like this. If you really focus on retention, that's really, I remember hearing Bill Clark one time saying, you know, 10 is the new 20 when it comes to new members. And there's a lot of truth. You know, there was, I remember hearing him say, I don't know any problem in the martial arts business that 20 new members a month doesn't solve. You know what I mean? Which there's a lot of truth to that. But
sure.
But here, my point is that, okay, our goal is to make it work with, you know, sometimes we might get, some schools might get a lot more members than that, but to make it work with 15 members in a month. Right. And if you do that and you're really sophisticated on how you're using the internet and you're sticking with tried and true stat, you know, procedures, and then you are servicing the tar out of your students. There's so much that goes into keeping a member. You know what I'm saying? They have so many reasons to quit from the time they start till they get their black belt. There are so many opportunities, you know, that and kind of once you know what those are, then you can say, okay, you know, at blue belt, we call it the blue belt blues, right? You know, we know that that's a lull. It's kind of halfway between the two. So then we will inject some stuff to address that ahead of time. You know, so we try to stay ahead of the curve, and that doesn't keep people from quitting, but it dramatically, you know, we know that if we do our job right, if we have passionate instructors that know what they're doing, communicate equally with everybody, and we do all the back office communication stuff correctly, then we have a good chance of keeping, you know, our goal is to have a 3% quit rate for what, basically, I know what you need, but for someone listening, that means that out of every 100 students, every month we want 97 of them to stick around. We only want 3 to quit. So if you have a school of 300 members, okay, and you have a 3% quit rate, that means every month you're losing 9 members. Mm-hmm. That means if you're gaining 10, you're breaking. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? So, mm-hmm. And that's a stat that most people don't keep track of, and that's, they just focus on how many new members, right. And it's a big mistake. It's like what happens, and you get this churn going. Like, you know, you'll hear people talk about, yeah, I have a small school. You should be able to do it with 100 members. By the way, not only having a small school, it's totally cool. But, you know, a guy will tell you, yeah, I be able to do it, you know, 100 members, 120, you make a great living in it. And then you ask them how many new members they're getting, and they're getting 18 new members a month because they're busting their butt to get new members. Like, really? And you only have 100 members. How many did you have a year ago? Oh, 100. So what you're saying is, see where I'm getting at?
Yeah, absolutely.
Which tells me the backstory is your service sucks and your reputation is bad. Mm-hmm. So now you have to do hardcore sales to keep up on it. And it becomes this really, you know, this vicious cycle that's hard to break.
And
so our kind of model is get them and keep them, you know, charge a high monthly rate. We don't care if we get paid in fulls. We don't push for them at all. We don't care about long-term programs. We just try to get them and keep them. And that's such a nice sustainable model. You know, it takes a while to build it up, but in the long haul, it's something you can do for decades.
It takes a bit of faith as well, right? Particularly if it's such that it's not going to pay off, possibly won't pay off for a little bit.
Yeah.
And at the same time, like, that's in the future. Today, like, as you, to your point, like, my rent is due tomorrow.
Hey, I've been there. I've been there. And I have been to a point to where I had to figure out, okay, which student can pay in full for the next 3 years so I can make my rent, you know, in a week. I've been there. A lot of people. But, okay, every now and then you got to do what you got to do. But how many times have I coached a school owner that it'll say, yeah, Mr. Colbert, man, I need some help. And I go, how many, you know, tell me, I'll ask him some numbers. And I'll say, how many students do you have? I have 200. Like, okay, that's pretty good. You know, and what's your monthly tuition? Okay, well, you know, and then I ask, you know, how many are paid in full? 180. Okay, you see what I'm talking about? Now that's a bad place to be.
Right.
And so then all of a sudden it forces you to have a certain way to do mentality. So you're really not thinking about retaining your members because they already paid. Not that you do that consciously, but at an unconscious basis, you're thinking, okay, I need more, and there's your focus. Right. So the people you have kind of And so kind of like when you're earning your money every month from these people, it changes your focus a little.
Yeah. Now I'm going to go switch gears a little bit because you're married, you got children as well. And what was this like? Because you found out early on that you were pretty much all in on this martial arts thing.
Right.
How did that play in terms of having that family life? Was it always kind of dad or, my husband, that this is his thing and we're just going to go along with it and that's just the way it goes? Or was it smooth sailing with that? Or,
because
you're spending a lot of time on the floor and doing all that kind of stuff as well.
First off, my wife is extremely understanding, she gets it, but that doesn't mean it's been easy, when the kids were little, I know a lot of people, and of course we have a bunch of the guys that are running schools for us, they're right there, they're in their mid to late 30s, they've got kids in grade school, I get it, man. And so we're very flexible with our guys. In other words, if you arrange to get off Wednesdays early, man, do what you got to do to take care of your family. But then what I did in my school, what we did is that I was always the guy. I arranged my schedule to where, first off, I took my kids to school every day and I picked them up. And I had that time in the early afternoon with them. But most evenings I wasn't home. You can't be home every evening if you're teaching classes. It's the reality of it. And then I would have, depending on the time of year, but I would have a day, a week during the week, like Monday through, usually it was a Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday, where I'd get off early and have dinner and stay the rest of the evening for the most part. But really, how many professionals, we're not the only people that have jobs that take them work from their family. So there's this assumption that it's only us. Mm. Well, pretty much, I have a friend who's a very successful attorney. And, he spends a lot of time late at night in the office because that's what you got to do. So you got someone that's in law enforcement. Guess what? They're working that swing shift. So we're not the only people. Not everybody else has 9-to-5 jobs, right? And so I think the thing is that you just try to find a way to make it work. And then the other thing that happened to me is I've never been like a crazy sports fan. I'm the guy that would, watch games here and there. It's funny because nobody on my team really does either. The martial arts is our thing. That's what we do. But I share this with you because when my son, Alex, who's now 24, when he was, I used to watch NFL, from basically August through December, I was watching football every Sunday. And when my son kind of was like 3-4 years old and, he's getting to be that age and I'm working a lot of times 6 days a week, it would be, hey, Alex, come down. Let's watch the game together. And he had no friggin' interest. And then it hit me. Okay, am I gonna take the one day off with my family and selfishly? You know what I'm talking about? So I just turned the TV off, and I basically, and I tried a couple years later, was older, no interest. So I just really reserved that time off to be all in with my family. You know what I'm saying? And to where, okay, I'm not the guy that. Had other hobbies that would take him away on weekends with the guys. It was like, okay, I don't golf, so my time off, it's either, I'm going to hang out with my kids. Now my kids are grown now I still try to spend time with them when I can, but it's a different space. But that's kind of, you find a way, you find a way to make it.
Yeah. What was your approach with your children, particularly with martial arts? Is it something that you said, were you hands off, or were you like, okay, well, you're going to do this? I mean,
it's a really great question. So first and foremost, do you have kids?
I do.
So
four daughters. Yeah.
four daughters. Yeah. How old are they?
They range from 10 to 6 months.
Wow. You're a busy dude, man.
I'm very busy.
So my kids, you want your daughters, do they train?
Yes, the two older ones do. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. So the kids coming out of the womb, they're going to train. They're going to train. That's all.
That's your attitude.
So, yeah. So one of the things I wanted my son to, when he's 4 years, 3.5, I'm going out of school and I'm putting even probably younger than that. When he's 2, what I'm doing is I'm putting like a little rubber knife in his hand. I'm saying, okay, try to tag daddy. So I can work on my knife defenses, right? He thinks we're playing and I'm actually getting some training.
Right.
Surprise how many times a 3-year-old can stab you because he doesn't know you're a black belt. and not supposed to be able
to stab somebody.
Yeah. But the deal was, is that, and so then, you know, I got him finally started in classes, and you know, he wasn't really that interested. Now, but what I told him is two things. So I told him, hey, there's two things you got to do. And this, I started having this conversation when they're probably 4 years old. You got to go to school and you got to do martial arts. Now, everything else, you can try soccer, you can try a musical instrument. If you try soccer, you got to play the whole season. But I just tried to program out of the gate. And then I was upset because my son wasn't as intense as I wanted him to be. And I wanted him to be Ernie Reyes Jr. You know, that's who I wanted him to be, right? I had all the plans for him to be. And my daughter, you know, she was going to be Arlene Lemus. You know what I mean? That was going to be the deal. I had a good friend of mine, you probably haven't heard the name. His name is Eddie Solis. And his son, James Solis, was a super high-level NASCAR competitor. But he told me something. He goes, you know, Dave, because his son just, like, took to it, right? He just loved it. He said, do you want your son to be, a really good black 12-year-old, but then hate martial arts for the rest of his life? Or do you want someone who loves martial arts? And you ought to back off a little bit. So what I did is I just basically – he just went there twice a week, like every other kid. You know what I'm saying? That was it. But we were pretty consistent about it. And same thing with my daughter. They ended up then, of course, getting on the demo team. So it was a very big part of life. They both still train. Mm-hmm. But now I've got two adult kids that, you know, enjoy martial arts still. Mm-hmm. And maybe not to the level that I do, right? But that's okay. You know, that's their own path. And so my advice to people is, and it's just, somebody else might say, I mean, how many professional athletes will tell you that their dad pushed the crap out of them? Probably a lot of them. Mm. And so who's to say that's not a good approach, right? But for me, my gut was saying, I'm going to push him away if I do that. So I'm not going to push him too hard. Mm-hmm. And that's worked for me, and that's what I suggest, especially when someone's a lower ranks. You know, I think a lot of parents, they want their kid, they live vicariously through their kid.
Sure.
And they push really hard, but so often that drives them away. And I call it the Cornette effect. And it comes from when I was in fourth grade, the summer before fourth grade, like in May, my folks got me, I wanted a clarinet. I wanted a clarinet. I played it all summer, didn't know what I was doing. It sounded a great time. I was going to be the best clarinet player on the planet. And as school started, I think I had like two private lessons over the summer, and so I had a few things to practice on. School started, my instructor said, all right, now, Dave, you got to practice every day for a half an hour. And my folks looked at me and said, you hear that? And all of a sudden, why aren't you practicing? And it took the fun out of it, and I ended up quitting about 2 months into it. Mm-hmm. I've never forgot that story. And so, you know, my advice to parents, kids that have of young children, is that ease them into things. I think for like what you want your child, like for me, for martial arts, what I want my students that come into my school, two things that I can do for them. And this is people of all ages. Number one, I want to help them develop a love for martial arts. And number two is just get them in the habit of coming to class a couple times a week. And if we can do that, we can just get them in the habit of coming to class and help them develop a love for martial arts. And then the third thing is try to get them thinking long term. Then eventually, now this is habit. I do this Mondays and Wednesdays at 5:00. I've been doing it for 3 years. Okay, there's an opportunity to do more. Eventually, you can start adding on, stacking. You know what I'm saying? And pushing a little harder. But if you do that too, you know, because martial arts is now kind of hardwired into their, you know, into their system, right? But if you do that too soon, you're going to scare people away. And I used to do that with my students. Parents would come in, and I would say, okay, now your kid's got to practice. And so now, man, I don't even care if my white belts practice at all. Don't even worry about it, mom and dad. Don't even worry. Just get them to have it coming to class. Just have a good time. Over time, we'll get them going. And it seems to work pretty well. Every now and then, you got that exceptional kid, to be sure. There's always going to be an exception. But the average kid, I think that's the appropriate approach with any type of recreational sport.
You've got some, you're fairly prominent in the industry. you've been around for a long time, but also in terms of like, you know, being able to help so many people grow their own schools and help them. How do you see yourself and what your role is in the industry? Or do you see that at all for you?
So it's an interesting question. I probably spend, you know, we have two businesses, right? I mean, we have a chain of schools. I say we because I've got a team of people, right? It's not just me by any stretch. And we also have Kovar Systems where we coach other martial arts schools. And that's where I tend to spend most of my time. And it just kind of evolved into it. You know, we attempt at a national expansion in the early 2000s. We got infused with a bunch of venture capital money. A guy approached us. We successfully identified something that didn't work. And in the process, we uncovered a lot of extra debt that we're still taking care of. You know, how are we going to pay all this debt? Well, so we went beyond our schools, you know, and that's kind of our plan was to. And so we have a very successful consulting business. That's originally we got into it because we were trying to figure out how to. That was going to be our way. We were going to grow, but now it's worked into something that we are helping a lot of schools, and I really enjoy. You know, I really enjoy that. That's kind of the next. I could go out and teach a beginner's class right now. I'd have a great time, but I don't know that I want to do it 10 times a week. You know what I'm saying? Followed by an intermediate class. I mean, I've done that. You know, that's kind of right now. I kind of feel like where I can have the most impact is, you know, like helping other school owners. So, that's kind of where I focus as far as where I'm at. You know, I think I see all these young guys. What I mean, young guys, is some guy that's in his 30s, maybe 40s, okay, or something like that. That's like, you know. They've got enough experience to where they know what they're doing, but they still got enough youth to have all that energy. Mm. But they came up with all, because we now, this is a legitimate industry, you know, and it wasn't a legitimate industry for so long, where they've got, you know, no bad habits, and I see them just kill it. I think, wow, yeah, I got to stay relevant, because otherwise you're kind of talking about what we did back in the, you know, sure. So what I try to do in kind of my position in the industry is try to make sure I stay up on what the heck is going on, you know, pay attention to what's going on and be aware of trends, but also know that, you know, there's some truths that are universal that are going to always be there. And, you know, there's going to be different ways that you advertise, you know what I'm saying? Like there's different ways you can get new members, and there's going to be different, but I think, you know, as long as my kind of what I want to tell people is that you don't friggin' have to be slick to do make a good living teaching. You know what I mean by that? Like meaning, and by the way, you got to run a good business. You can't just teach good classes, but you know, if you just go out of your way to have a good product, and by the way, you got to take a look at your curriculum or whatever you teach and make sure that it doesn't matter how badly you think people need to learn it. You know, the market will tell you if it's, you know, like how many times do I have guys tell me, no adults want to do it. You know, I only have kids in my school, you know. Right. Well, you know, we have more kids than adults, right? But we actually have a really cool adult program too, because I've tried to be aware of what they need, what they're looking for. And right. I've modified my curriculum accordingly. A lot of people have not done that. So, by the way, there's nothing wrong with like teaching a traditional martial arts the way you taught it, the way your instructor taught it, they taught you. That's totally cool. I totally respect that. That sometimes there might be a price for that. You know what I'm saying? And my original system, and I still teach it. I call it a blended Kempo style, but my original system is an American Kempo. However, my instructor was very much a cross trainer early, so I was doing. Okay. You know, jiu-jitsu back in the 70s and Filipino weaponry and this, you know, so he was very much kind of a mixed, we can call multi-style martial artist.
Progressive even back in the day then.
Yeah. So that's the way I always kind of looked at it. But you know, there was, I had 22 forms, really long Kempo forms, and almost 400 self-defense techniques, if you include variations, for my black belt. And so what happened was, is that I still remember it all because I was wired into me. So I knew so many different ways to defend against a shoulder grab. But if you grab my shoulder, I couldn't tell you what to do because nothing came out. You know what I'm saying? So it was a different, this alphabet was way too big. So I started modifying that early on. I realized, man, you know, 40 self-defense techniques per belt rank. And you know, it's like you spend all your time, all these long forms. And I started thinking, okay, by the way, there's nothing wrong with doing that if that's what you want to do. But I started thinking, what do I want my black belts to look like, act like, know, and be? Does my curriculum match that? And I realized it really didn't match. So I started cutting back. And originally I had a bunch of guys that I was like the devil incarnate because I was modifying stuff and taking forms out. And, you know, and now a lot of those same guys have come back and go, how do you do that again? Let me see. They kind of follow suit or, you know, other people have done it. So I totally feel like if you – the ability to kind of adjust with the times, I got sidetracked. I forgot where we're at, but if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, you talk about how, you know, staying relevant and making those changes and adjusting, et cetera. Is there something that happened in the, you know, whether it's the martial arts industry or even just, you know, for you personally, that was a challenge, a really big challenge for you to kind of adjust and get with the times, or, you know, stay relevant?
So, you know, it's an ongoing process. You know, I'll be with my guys and, you know, our team. You know, we're very fortunate that we have a lot of tenure in our organization. So these guys that are with me, have been with me for a long time, a lot of them 20 years, right? But we'll be sitting in the office and we will be talking about some kind of procedure on the mat, and someone will pop their hand up and they'll have this idea. And I have this desire to say, that won't work. I tried it in 92. I will never work back in the 80s. I did this, have to just freaking shut my mouth.
Mm.
For a couple of reasons. Number one is that you will stifle creativity if you don't let it happen, right? Mm. But secondly, hey, man, maybe it was me. Maybe, in other words, so I have to, Shoshin, I'm not familiar with the term Shoshin. Basically means beginner's mind. And beginner's mind, you know, basically it means you have no assumptions. Someone's walking on the floor for the first time, right? And so I have to really mindfully empty my cup, because otherwise I'll start like, so I try to be conscious of it. And then, you know, it's pretty amazing what some of the people are doing in the way. And then I also I'm aware of what's going on, but I'm just kind of focusing on what I know how to do. If that makes any sense.
Absolutely. So you're saying that even after you get to a certain level, this is still something that you have to work on.
I think, in the last year, I've got three guys that that are old friends that I've known since the early 90s.
Hmm.
These guys were on the top of the pack in the 90s in the martial arts business community. They were the top of the pack. That all these three particular guys, all struggling for survival because the business has changed and they didn't. And I'm trying to coach them through how to stay and freaking keep the doors open. Mm-hmm. Right? It's sad to see, right? And what happened was somewhere along the line, a couple things. Number one is they lost that hunger, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But they quit paying attention to what's going on. They didn't stay relevant. And so now, you know, one of the guys has clearly made turn the corner. The other two guys, I don't know, man. I don't know if they can do it. And of course, now their bodies are older and beat up, and they can't, they know what they know, but what they know, a lot of people really don't want to know anymore. You know what I'm saying? It's like, or it's harder to sell, it's harder to, and so, that would be mindfully when I see that, I remind myself, okay, pay attention, stay relevant, stay hungry. But you gotta temper it as well. In other words, you've got to make sure that you're not, in other words, you got to take time off. You gotta, it can't be all push, because that's the other thing where people fizzle out, because I've seen it where guys are just doing killer work and also they fall off the radar. Mm. And what happened was, is the rest of their life was completely out of balance. And once that happens, then that usually doesn't, good things don't follow.
Dave Kofar, this was amazing. I really appreciate your time here.
My pleasure.
I think, I could talk to you for hours, for days.
Well, thank
but,
you.
Listen, I want to be respectful of your time. If people want to get more of you, what's the best way for them to do that?
So, I have a podcast. It's called The Satori Lifestyle. And so they can get that anywhere you can get podcasts, and they can get a hold of me through Kofar Systems. And I've got a couple of people that have martial arts schools, Kofar Systems. If you're people listening to that, we have a lot of products where we can help people. And I also, for the general public, I have a couple books. It's one called Brief Moments of Clarity, which is kind of, I guess, my version of Chicken Soup for the Soul, kind of thing. And then another one on a dad's toolbox for better parenting. Mm. And it's kind of like what we did is we kind of applied some of the stuff that I've learned as an instructor and how it relates to parenting. And so you can get those on Amazon. And I also have another martial arts book called The Instructor's Toolbox, Martial Arts Instructor's Toolbox, which has got some nice tips for people as to how to be a better teacher as well. So I appreciate you having me on the podcast. I wish you the best of luck.
Folks, I hope you appreciated that conversation with Hanchi Kovar. That was just one of the highlights of my time doing this podcast. And I hope you got a lot out of it, too. I mean, one of the things that really stands out for me, not only from the podcast and our conversation, but also, you know, anything that I've seen him put out, particularly in terms of videos and posts on Facebook, is just the way that he carries himself in terms of his humility and, you know, just he doesn't judge, you know, other folks. And I really appreciate that. It's something that I like to cultivate as much as I can in myself as well. So I really appreciate Hanchi Kovar for his time and his insights talking with me. But that is it for today's episode. This is Philip with the Everyday Fighter Podcast. We'll talk to you next time.